Coming up Saturday afternoon at 2 on Hometown Heroes, we prepare for this week's 69th anniversary of D-Day by hearing from someone who was there.
The sea was red with blood. The foam was red. You couldn't hardly breathe. So much sulfur in the air from explosions. The noise was baffling.
Don't miss Hometown Heroes Saturday afternoon at 2 on News Talk 920 KVEC.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, where each week we visit with veterans, mostly from our greatest generation. We want to honor them for their service, their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories for posterity, so we remember the price of freedom. And along the way, I think we can also be educated and inspired a little bit when we hear how much they love their country, what lengths they were willing to go for the red, white, and blue. Maybe it helps the rest of us to live up to that legacy a little bit, too. It's called Hometown Heroes because I'm convinced that no matter where you live in the U.S. of A., no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, men and women who have done more than we'd ever imagine for the sake of our freedom. This coming Thursday, we will mark the 69th anniversary of D-Day, June 6th, 1944, the start of Operation Overlord, that pivotal invasion of Normandy. 73,000 Americans went ashore on D-Day. 2,500 died there on that day alone. Over the years, I've had the privilege of meeting many brave men who were involved in one way or another in that massive operation. We'll hear from some of them. But to start things off today, I thought I would take you back to June 6, 1944, in a very real way, to hear from the voices of some very significant Americans what was said that day on radios all over this country. And if you were alive back then, something maybe you even remember. First, we're going to hear what General Dwight David Eisenhower had to say to the Allied troops preparing to make that invasion of Europe. Here's General Eisenhower on June 6th, 1944.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
So that was General Dwight Eisenhower addressing the troops, but the commander-in-chief also had something to say that day, June 6, 1944. Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation, the president asking Americans everywhere to unite in prayer. And as you listen to this speech, this prayer by the president of the United States, maybe ask yourself if we would hear something similar today or even in the last few decades. And for those of you who, like me, were not born yet in June of 1944, maybe this will give you a glimpse of how all-consuming, how incredibly crucial the mission was then, and how united the people of our United States were at that moment in history. Here is President Franklin Delano Roosevelt on June 6th, 1944.
My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tried by night and by day without rest, until the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. For these men are lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters, and brothers of brave men overseas, whose thoughts and prayers are ever with them, help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in thee in this hour of great sacrifice. Many people have urged that I call the nation into a single day of special prayer. But because the road is long and the desire is great, I ask that our people devote themselves in a continuance of prayer, as we rise to each new day, and again when each day is spent, let words of prayer be on our lips, invoking thy help to our efforts. Give us strength, too, strengthen our daily tasks, to redouble the contributions we make in the physical and the material support of our armed forces. And let our hearts be stout to wait out the long travel, to bear sorrows that may come, to impart our courage unto our sons, wheresoever they may be. And, O Lord, give us faith. Give us faith in thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade. Let not the keenness of our spirit ever be dulled. Let not the impacts of temporary events of temporal matters of but fleeting moment. Let not these deter us in our unconquerable purpose. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace. A peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen.
So that was President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR, addressing the nation on June 6, 1944, 69 years ago this Thursday. There was actually a bill introduced in Congress last week that would have a portion of that prayer inscribed on the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. It's my hope that all the veterans we hear from on this program would have the chance to visit their memorial in Washington, D.C. And Honor Flight is an organization that gives us all the opportunity to make that possible for them. I'll let World War II veteran and former Senator Bob Dole bend your ear a bit about that. And then after the break, we'll hear about D-Day from some people who survived it. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes.
Hello, I'm Bob Dole, speaking for the Honor Flight Network and asking for your help. America owes a debt of gratitude to the 16.5 million World War II veterans who, without doubt, helped save the world. Today, the ranks of our most senior heroes are dwindling. More than 1,200 of these heroes die each day. Those in their 80s and 90s lack the means to safely visit the National World War II Memorial, which honors their service and sacrifice. Every week, the Honor Flight Network flies veterans free of charge to Washington to see firsthand the National World War II Memorial erected in their honor. These veterans are flown to Washington from all parts of the country. Your generosity will help continue the Honor Flight program for these greatest generation veterans. And I urge you with all my heart to give whatever you can.
Visit honorflight.org to find the local hub nearest you. That website, honorflight.org.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, a special D-Day edition as we prepare for the 69th anniversary of what's been called the longest day, June 6th, 1944. I've had the privilege of meeting quite a few men and even women who were involved that day in a variety of ways. In Atwater, California, a nurse who treated some of the wounded. In El Paso, Texas, a group of paratroopers who jumped behind enemy lines on June 6th. In Woodlake, California, a glider pilot who knew how he'd get in but wasn't sure how he'd get out. There are so many different stories from that monumental effort, but one of the most emotional and well-told stories about D-Day that we've heard on this program comes from a gentleman named Philip Houck. He goes by Pete. He's 92 now, and he's looking forward to taking a trip to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight. He served with the 502nd Engineers, but before we hear about his experience on D-Day, let's get this. Before the war, he met a beautiful young lady named Beverly in Pocatello, Idaho.
Yes, I asked her to marry me, and she said yes, and her father said no. He was the smart one, though. He took me to one side and said, you know, if you get hurt or if you die, you're going to leave her here heartbroken and maybe pregnant. And he said, that's not really something I think you want to do. So he said, I'm going to ask you kids to wait until you come home. But I met Beverly. This is an odd thing. I was cleaning the meat case in this meat market on a Sunday because that was the day we didn't have too many people. Mm-hmm. When two ladies walked up, and I was looking at them through the glass, and one pair of those legs really stood out. And I bumped my head getting out of there, and there was Beverly. And I put my eye on her, and I set my cap for her, and we've been together ever since.
Well, and that wasn't easy because you had some things to endure overseas while she waited for you. And I guess a meat cutter would know a good pair of legs when he saw one, huh?
Yeah. Well, she was very busy in this country. She made bandages. In those days, a lot of the young ladies and older ladies made bandages for soldiers. She wrote to me every day. I was reported lost in action, my mail got backed up. When I got home, I had 2 4-foot-tall barracks bags full of mail, most of it from Beth. I have some today that are not even opened yet.
You haven't opened them?
We open a few on every anniversary.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yep.
So you've got this lovely young lady who's writing you letters, who's waiting for you to get back. Did that give you, you think, a little better focus or mindset as you headed overseas?
Yes, I think so. To know that someone cares. So I think that when people write letters to servicemen, they're really doing a great favor to them.
And that is still true today.
Yep.
Absolutely. Now, how often did you get to write her back? And do you have any of those letters still?
I don't think we have many of those. And, of course, I was on the front line from June the 6th until December the 24th. Out of that time, we had 4 rest areas where we bathed, cleaned up a bit, and had, maybe 4 or 5 days rest. That was while we were being refurbished with equipment. You know, it gets pretty shot up by the time you're in battle. I was unfortunate or fortunate to be in 4 major spearheads, so therefore you don't have a lot of extra time. But I wrote her as often as I could, at least I think once a week or thereabouts. And sometimes it was underneath a blanket at night with a flashlight, you know, raining. The damn blanket had more water in it than the rain.
Well, that just makes it that much more noble to get the task done and get that letter off to her. Well, we're going to talk about June 6th in a few moments, but there were some things that happened before that. You get to England, you're training with these other gentlemen, and you're getting the sense that something big is going to happen pretty soon. Now, one incident that we've heard about on this show before, but maybe a lot of people aren't familiar with, happened in late April in England. This was basically a big practice by Allied forces for the Normandy invasion, but it didn't go as planned. What was your experience with what's been called Exercise Tiger or Operation Tiger?
Right. Well, Exercise Tiger was more or less the last run we were going to make before we hit the beaches. And we were in the English Channel. We went out in small boats. They're called LCIs. That means landing craft for infantry. And we had some LCTs, which was for trucks and tanks. And we were practicing our run on the beach. That's just south of Torquay, a very nice little city. And we had hit the beach first. Earl Couch, my best friend and buddy, we'd gotten into where the, we would call them dunes in this country, where piles of sand, of course, as you know, get washed up.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just climbing one of them when I thought it was 2 or 3 U-boats. Other people say it was only one. I can't really tell you, but they came up within 400 yards of us, maybe 5, and started blasting, and they killed many, many men. Fortunately for us, Earl and I were right on the top of one of these dunes, and we just jumped over. But the ammo that was hitting the dunes was enough to spray sand that would burn your face, and we were ducking for cover. The federal government would never agree that that ever happened, nor will they agree that they had guys like my outfit that went into Normandy way ahead of any artillery. We went into Clearpath for tanks and trucks, and they to this day haven't.
Well, that's why we're glad to have you here to tell us the story. And to wrap up that incident at Slapton Sands, the Exercise Tiger, and what I've read, nearly 1,000 Allied troops were killed in that action and another 200 wounded. There were some LSTs that were sunk and damaged. But what was the emotional toll of that? I mean, talk about a surprise attack. This is completely unexpected. Here you guys are getting ready to be the offender, and the sneak attack occurs on you and decimates your forces. That couldn't have boosted morale very much.
Well, the thing that happened, I think, to most of us was, you know, you're in cold water and you're freezing your little tinkus off. You think that there's nobody around you. So the surprise was really bitter. You not only were shaking from the cold, but from fear. And I know that 2 weeks later, when we did the same thing, I really wondered whether I wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that others felt the same way. But one thing we did was every week we trained to hit that beach. It was tough enough. From then on, it was we had more realization, I believe, after that.
And that training would come in handy on June 6th, 1944.
The vehicles that we used in those days were fairly simple, but they had to be waterproofed. It'd be difficult for you folks to understand this, but they had to be waterproofed right up to about your belt line. And I was on my vehicle, that means about 5 foot. But we had to put a tubing over the carburetor, the breather intake. We had to set the gas pedal, the throttle, and everything had to be preset. And when you started your vehicle to go offshore or onshore, everything had to be set. But prior to that, they dug a trench a quarter of a mile long with 5 foot of water in it. And before we loaded our vehicles on the LCTs, they had to pass the test of running through this 5 foot of water without stalling. The first two trucks ahead of me, of course, stalled. So they took them out, and that put me number one in line. So when I was fortunate enough to go through and get right up to the front of the ship, so when they dropped that nose of that LCT, that's where I was, first truck off.
And what, describe for our listeners, if you can, what this truck was like, what the purpose of it was, and why it was so important to be over there on that beach.
Okay, I had what they called a coffin box right behind my seat. It was made out of 3/4-inch steel, and it was full of C2. That's a highly explosive. We had been training with dynamite, but C2 came out and was invented about that time, so we switched over to C2. On my right, standing in the seat, was Lieutenant White, and he was manning a 30-caliber machine gun. So when we came off that ramp onto the end of the water, we were the first ones, and I guess maybe by surprise, we dropped into the water, and the water was up around my belly button. It had passed my belt, and the captain said, "For God's sake, are we going to hit the ground?" And about that time, all 8 wheels driving, we hit the ground.
Those had to be some nervous moments there. You could be sinking into the drink and holding up everyone else behind you.
That's right. But we made that, and in my shirt pocket and studied for weeks was the direction in which I was supposed to go. And, of course, I had a compass mounted on my rig, and there was a little ravine to my right, which we headed for. And unfortunately, the sea was red with blood. The foam was red. You couldn't hardly breathe. So much sulfur in the air. from explosions. The noise was baffling. And I was driving over pieces of human being.
I can see you and hear you. I know our listeners can hear you. They hear the emotion in your voice, and I can almost feel what that does to you, to take yourself back to that moment. And here you are. You're a 23-year-old kid witnessing all this.
It wasn't what I expected. But anyway, we got up into the ravine where they could not fire ammunition our way. And I said, how far up this ravine you want to go, Lieutenant? And he said, why don't you stop it right here, and we'll wait for the crew to come up. Well, he stepped out of the unit, and I was sitting there shaking. And the warmth that was running down my legs was not from the ocean. I was scared to death.
Who could blame you? And anyone who's seen or read anything about that day and that location knows that there were many men who did not live to talk about it, and you had witnessed so many of them. And it sounds like at that moment you felt like you were probably going to be next.
You really, at that time, didn't know. There were probably several thousand bodies on the beach and many that never made the beach. And when the lieutenant came back, he said, I would like you to round up your crew. My crew was 14 men, and we were in demolition. And he said, there are two bunkers that are still alive. It means that they were still firing on the troops down on the beach. And he said, see what you guys can do about blowing it up. The Germans called them Weiterstandnesters. They're made of 12-foot thick concrete with 1-inch reinforced rod running through them. They have a small donkey train inside linking them together where they haul their ammunition and stuff. And they only had a slit in the front part of these Weiterstandnesters that was about 6 inches, maybe 8, wide, and ran the full length of a 25-foot bunker. And in that, they would have machine guns on what they call arbitrating fire. It would fire back and forth and interlink and back and forth. There were really no men shooting per se through sights at the men on the beach. But there were so many thousand rounds going down and so many thousand men, the automatic machine guns couldn't miss anybody.
Absolutely. It's just a wall of gunfire, basically.
Yeah, right. That they were up against.
Right.
So pretty soon Earl came up. That's Earl Couch, my best friend. And he said, what's on the docket, Pop? And I said, well, leave your rifle, your canteens, anything extra you got, and put 25 pounds of explosives on your back and pots and Meyer and the 14 of us started crawling to the back of, I think it's bunker number 3 or Weiterstandnester number 3. And he said, Jesus Christ, who's going to be our backup? Meaning, who's going to protect us? Well, the 1340th engineers were primarily our backup, and they came behind us just with their own rifles. And so we worked our way up to the back door of number 3, and we put all of this powder or putty, whatever you want to call it. Some comes in brick, and some you can roll up in your hand and put around a tree and cut a tree down. But we blew the back door out, and then the 1340th came up and killed everybody that came out the door. And then we did that to one other one, and I keep forgetting whether it was Weiterstandnester 2 or 3. And as soon as we finished that one, we had a little whistle that if an officer needed someone or if there was a new project or something coming up that we recognized. And I don't know who it was that gave us the high sign, but we then went to where the trucks were trying to come up off of the sand, and they wanted us to build a road and out of steel netting. Then we went into that road, and it was dark when we quit. I can't even remember, like maybe 8 o'clock at night or 7. And, of course, there was no chow that night and nothing to sleep in, so we slept in the sand. And that was the first day.
The longest day?
The longest day.
And believe it or not, that day was even longer for Pete than he initially let on. Wait until you hear about the top secret assignment he had carried out before all of what we just heard had unfolded on Omaha Beach. The rest of this D-Day edition of Hometown Heroes when we come back. Next June will mark the 70th anniversary of D-Day, and one band from California will be there in Normandy to mark the occasion. The Clovis Community Band is raising money now to join other bands from around the world in forming the D-Day 70 Memorial Wind Band. They'll be conducted on June 6, 2014 at the Normandy American Cemetery and Memorial by Arnold Gabriel, conductor emeritus of the U.S. Air Force Band and a man who actually fought as a machine gunner in Normandy during World War II. To donate or find out more about the Clovis Community Band's trip to Normandy, call 559-299-0471. That's 559-299-0471. Or check out this website, ClovisCommunityBandDday.org.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, preparing for Thursday's 69th anniversary of D-Day by listening to now 92-year-old Philip Pete Houck. He relayed coming ashore on Omaha Beach, crawling with 14 others to blow up two German bunkers, disabling machine gun emplacements in the process and thus saving the lives of many, many Americans. But Pete's duties on June 6, 1944, actually began much earlier in the day.
Well, I didn't tell you what actually happened because the federal government doesn't want it known. But at 3:45 in the morning, my crew went overboard on the ship, climbed down a rope netting into a 22-foot rubber raft. It was powered by a Lee J engine, which was electric, made absolutely no noise. And with an azimuth and a compass in my hand, we headed for the beach. Our job that night was to take out the big tank embutments that are pieces of steel that are crossed with 12-inch steel embedded in 15 feet of concrete. And they're a blockage so that trucks and tanks cannot reach the shore. And they were pretty sure that these would not be knocked out by the naval guns, and they weren't. So we went into the beach, and we put these bandoliers and C2 around the concrete portions, hoping to get it as far down as we could. I remember Earl, he said to me, he had a hold of my belt, and he said, "Pop, what the hell is this?" And of course he had his hand on a trigger mine, and I said, "Well, if you don't let go of it easily, it could blow you up." I said, "It's a mine," and I won't say what he said.
I can imagine.
But we put our detonators in there and then put a time charge on them so that they would go off. It was scheduled, I think, for, my memory's not so good, I think 5:45 or 6 o'clock was the time that was going to be the big firing. And then we headed back to our ship, and that was another scary time. If you can imagine, you're in a little boat, and these huge ships are covering that sea, and they're about 40 to 60 feet above you, and you're trying to find the ship you're supposed to go back to, And there are literally thousands of them. Well, fortunately, our number was 575. And I spotted that number, and we got there just as they started hitting the beach with the big guns off of the ships. And the noise was unbelievable. You couldn't hear. Actually, you couldn't hear anything. You couldn't, not a thing. And after a few minutes, you couldn't see a thing. And if you could, you couldn't through the tears that were just automatically coming from the sulfur and the smell, you know, bad. But anyway, then I went back in. My first trip on the truck, of course, was at 10 o'clock in the morning.
And that's what you told us about before.
Yes.
Going in on the truck at 10 o'clock after these waves of troops had gone in, and you saw the remains of that in the aftermath.
Yeah.
But what I'm hearing you say here is that basically you guys had a top secret mission basically as frogmen to sneak in there in the cover of darkness and lace these charges.
Right. And we didn't have frog suits either. I'm going to tell you. Your scrotum will shrink up like a pea.
Yeah, that English Channel was pretty cold, I'm sure. I guess the question is, did it work? Everyone's seen.
Yeah, I actually drove into the area we opened up.
So you had blown some of those out of the way and you were able to drive in the very spot.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. We once had on this program a man who was on the ship that fired the first shots at Point Du Hoc, but you were there before anybody else was on
but
that beach, basically.
I wasn't at Point Du Hoc.
Right. I know. I'm saying we've had some firsts on this show, but we haven't had a first like this. It sounds to me like you were on that beach before basically any other Allied troops.
We could hear the Germans speaking.
Did you speak German? Did you understand?
No. No. I am of German descent, but I could remember things my grandfather said, but I could just recognize the voice, you know, and hear them speaking to one another. Because voices carry over water pretty good. And we were only probably 3 football fields from them.
How afraid were you that you were going to be discovered and that you were going to die right there before the invasion ever started?
You know, at that particular time, I wasn't afraid. The menace hadn't happened. I was cold as hell, but and shaking, but from cold, not from fear. Knowing, though, that we were on their doorstep, I can remember Potts saying, "Hitler, you better count your chickens as we put that stuff in there."
Yeah, and that's a story that I've never heard, so it's a definite treat to hear.
Well, it's not supposed to be told, I don't think.
They wouldn't prosecute a 90-year-old man for saying what he did in the war, would they?
I don't think anybody else is left.
Well, and you've already shared how that day ended up. But so you go from 3:45 in the morning, hitting the beach on this secret mission, taking the beach again at 10 a.m. on your truck after you just barely made it back to your ship in time to go in with them, and then blowing up these bunkers. You had to have been running on adrenaline this whole time because you certainly weren't rested. You had to be exhausted, and you end up sleeping on the sand that night. Do you remember what kind of things went through your head, or did you just collapse from sheer exhaustion and not have any time to think about what you'd experienced that day?
Well, I know it was after dark. We had laid the road. We had gotten it down to the beach, probably 400 or 500 yards of track for the trucks to come up, because as they come off those ships, the more that came off, the worse the ground became. It became more loose, and they had a hard time. Matter of fact, they couldn't get up. They were starting to drag them up with cats and tanks. Even the tanks were having trouble. So this road had to be put in there. And we had the 1340th and 570th, and this little bridging company that I belonged to, putting all that stuff up. So we got about dark, I guess. We were laying down, and the couch said, "You want a deration?" I said, "No, I only ate half of them around noon." If you don't know what a deration is, It's a chocolate bar.
Yeah.
That's about an inch thick and about 3 inches wide and about 4 inches long. Or maybe it's only 2 inches wide. And it's broke into three pieces. But one candy bar or one chocolate bar is a ration for one meal. We all had at least 5 or 6 in our pack. I was never, ever, ever able to eat more than a half of a one, sometimes only a quarter. But the little children that I met along the way sure loved them. I gave most of mine away, as a lot of the other guys did. I went 185 pounds when I hit the beach. And when I got to the hospital, I weighed 98 that fall.
Wow.
I'd had I don't know what they call them today. They call them something time away. But we would get a rest period about every 3 months when we got a shower. Then I went right back online. As I said earlier to you, Paul, the 502nd Engineers is a well-known company.
For good reason. And just for what you did that day on June 6th alone, I think our listeners are impressed, perhaps amazed, and hopefully very grateful for the courage you displayed that day. Now, I've seen a picture of you holding a board with all your medals, and I saw on there the Bronze Star. Was that a result of June 6th?
No.
So you didn't get anything?
Everybody should have had one that day. No. We were going into Bayeux, that's in France, where there wasn't supposed to be any Germans. And we were going to build a bridge, and it was quite down in quite a canyon. All the bridging equipment was in, and I'm lots of times third or fourth to last rig because I'm carrying pretty explosive stuff. When I got down to what we call the bridgehead, mortar fire was coming in from atop of a hill on the other side of the bridge, or the bridgehead. No bridge there. And Alvin Meyer was driving a truck loaded with creosoted lumber ahead of me, and a shell hit it and started it on fire. I grabbed my fire extinguisher and was putting it out when he jumped up onto the cotton picking truck. And we have material that we used to throw over the trucks in the daytime called camouflage, so that air traffic couldn't see it. And that crap caught fire. And so I just turned my fire extinguisher on him and on the truck and then jerked him down off of there. And the captain came up to me and he said, you could blow us all to hell with that equipment you got there. He said, you're going to have to try and turn it around on this narrow road and get the hell out of here. Well, when you take a vehicle into an unknown field that hasn't been searched for mines, that's a scary time. But I backed this unit into a field and then started up the incline. And, of course, they weigh pretty heavy and they don't travel very fast. And they were lobbing these damn mortars right behind me coming up the hill. And I guess for saving Alvin's life and doing that, they put me in for a Silver Star, but I think you have to be wounded also to get silver. I'm not sure, but
not necessarily. But it sounds, as I know now about the situation of your medals, you never actually received these till just a couple of years ago. So there was a lot of time that went between when you actually earned that medal and when they gave it to you. And maybe something was lost in translation there, and maybe you really did deserve the Silver Star. And I'll be honest with you, just hearing you describe what you guys did on June 6th, I would think that the highest medal the military gives would be in order. I think our listeners would say that too. I mean, I've heard a lot of stories and a lot of well-decorated soldiers, but to do what you guys did and to realize the significance of it in the big picture, that was pretty serious stuff you did June 6th.
Yeah, those guys all deserve it.
How long did it take before you realized how significant that day was and how significant everything that occurred that day ended up being?
Well, you know, we were spoken to by Dwight Eisenhower on the 5th.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you.
We actually went out in the water on the 5th and then came back because it was too high. But we knew when he spoke to us like he did that many of us may not make it. I think we knew all along that it was a hair-raising situation. I don't believe I ever felt fear after that day. I knew it was there and around me. But I prayed a lot.
Who would blame you?
One morning, Potts hollered over to Earl Couch, one of his friends, and he said, "How'd you guys do last night?" Oh, I said, "Hell, we did fine. How said the 23rd Psalm all night long." We were in a situation, many people wouldn't understand this, but when you're in a forest and the Germans are firing 88 cannons into the treetops, not to the ground, but into the treetops where they would explode and rain shrapnel down on you. And they did that all night long, one night. And I may have been a little frightened, I think, that night. I'll take that back.
Did you even realize you were reciting the 23rd Psalm all night long?
I don't know. I don't know. But I'm a pretty good Christian, I can tell you that. He dug me out of a lot of holes.
Well, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but there may be a listener out there who hasn't heard the 23rd Psalm, who doesn't get the significance of that and the relation to the situation that you were in at that moment. Is that something that you'd like to reenact for us right now?
I don't think so. I think I'll break up, but I know that He'll lead you through the shadow of death, and you're not to fear any evil, for thou art with me.
And clearly he was with Pete Houck, 92 years old now. He and his wife, Bev, are still married all these years later. You'll find some pictures on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. They still have those letters, too. And Pete has given us a very personal look into June 6, 1944 in very emotional fashion. I doubt you're going to forget that. I know I never will. So when Thursday rolls around and you see that calendar turn to June 6th, how about taking a moment to pause and reflect on the sacrifices made by so many young men that day, so many who never made it to another day, and so many more, like Pete, who carried the memories, the scars of that longest day for so, so long. This may be stating the obvious just a bit, but having spent the last week in Washington, D.C., and getting yet another look at the World War II Memorial, all those gold stars and all the memories, I'm reminded that our world would be quite different today without that day, June 6th, 1944, and everything that followed. We're out of time on the program for today. Please join us again next week for another edition of Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.